and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, June 13th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Let's begin on page one. First article is titled, Celebrating Freedom, FD Entrepreneur MP Brown Honored at Juneteenth Event, by Bill Shea. When MP Brown arrived in Fort Dodge from Mississippi, he didn't have much. What he did have was an apparent knack for business and the willingness to work very hard. As a result, Brown became one of the first black business owners in Fort Dodge. His legacy was honored Saturday during a Juneteenth celebration hosted by Athletics for Education and Success. The event featured dances, food, information on black history, wellness checks, and games. It all took place at the AFES buildings on 3rd Street Northwest. Juneteenth commemorates June 19, 1865. That's the day when federal troops arrived in Galveston, Texas, and announced that slavery had been abolished. That action came some 3 years after President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed the slaves. The arrival of federal troops to enforce the proclamation in Galveston is considered to be the final end of slavery in the United States. Charles Clayton, the executive director of AFES, referred to an oak tree to explain the importance of Juneteenth to black Americans. He said if you plant an oak in a pot, it will be confined and only grow to a quarter of its potential size. But, he said, if you plant it in an open field, it will grow and reach its full strength. African Americans were at one point in a pot, he said. Thanks to the events of Juneteenth, they are no longer in that pot, he said. This day is very important to me for that reason, Clayton said. During its Juneteenth celebration, AFES honors a local citizen. This year's honoree was the late MP Brown. A plaque was presented to his grandson, Ira Shivers. Brown moved to Fort Dodge from Meridian, Mississippi in the 1950s or 60s. In Fort Dodge, he owned Brown's Cafe in the Pleasant Valley neighborhood, MP's Chicken at 1st Avenue South and 7th Street, a ceramic store, rental properties, and an arcade that offered pool, pinball, and candy. He also had an interest in a grocery store in Pleasant Valley called Two Sisters, which was owned by his wife, Charlie Mae Brown, and sister-in-law, Maddie Lee Preston. M.P. Brown did all that while working full-time as a janitor at Iowa Central Community College. Clayton described M.P. Brown as the first African-American entrepreneur in Fort Dodge. Shivers said his grandfather's businesses were in operation from the 70s to the mid-90s. He said his grandfather died unexpectedly and the businesses eventually closed. Shivers said his grandfather's example inspired him to open T.C. May's restaurant in Fort Dodge. He said recipes from Brown's Cafe and MP's Chicken are used at T.C. May's, which is now owned by his brother. MP Brown's son, Danny Brown, missed the presentation because he was outside grilling chicken, burgers, and hot dogs for those who attended the celebration. He said his father instilled a lot of nice things in his children. He was my hero, Danny Brown said. Everybody else has Superman or some other hero. My dad was my hero. Besides being a great black man, he was a great man, he added. He helped whenever and however he could. The celebration began at about noon with an opening prayer by Simeon Roberts. Flags were brought into the room by local young people. Kyler Preston brought the American flag. Amaris Kirkland held the African-American flag. Janae Newsom carried the Pan-African flag, and Brandon Newsom carried the Juneteenth flag. Al Womble, the president of the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus, talked about why people should not only vote, but also work for the candidates and issues that they support. To make his point, he recalled an election class president when he was in elementary school. He said he did not work for his friend in that election. Someone else won the election, and that girl had a big idea for an Easter pageant. The end result was that Womble had to walk around in a ridiculous Easter bonnet. Elections are important, he said. They affect and change our lives. Kinley Walker, Jasmine Dillard, and Layla Taylor wrapped up the program with vigorous solo dance routines. And I can read some of the captions from the pictures here. There's one that says, Al Womble, president of the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus, speaks about the importance of elections. Jasmine Dillard concludes her dance routine at the Juneteenth celebration. Stacy Silliman Jones and Connor Wooden pose with the Juneteenth flag following the celebration. Kinley Walker strikes a pose as she begins her dance routine at the Juneteenth celebration. Continuing with the Juneteenth theme, there is This headline reads, "Another Juneteenth celebration is this weekend," by Bill Shea. Fort Dodge is not done celebrating Juneteenth. A second Juneteenth celebration featuring food, basketball, and the recognition of people who have played key roles in the community will be held at H.C. Meriwether Park on June 18th. This will be the first time Fort Dodge has had two Juneteenth celebrations. "We're excited to see more Juneteenth celebrations," said Sherry Washington, a member of the Pleasant Valley Awareness Committee, which organized the upcoming event. The committee has held a Juneteenth celebration since 2018. This year's event will be from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at H.C. Meriwether Park on 10th Avenue Southwest. "Let's come together and let's make history," Washington said. A basketball game pitting Fort Dodge High School students against students from Ames will start at noon. Willie Williams, Fort Dodge Senior High School's head boys basketball coach, will coach the Fort Dodge team. Leonard Naylor, a standout Fort Dodge basketball player in the 1970s, will coach the Ames team. Fort Dodge City Councilman Quentin McCaleb will be the referee. At 1:30 p.m., Mayor Matt Bemrich will read a Juneteenth proclamation. The recognition and awards presentation will follow the proclamation. Washington said the honorees will include Councilman Terry Menke, State Representative Ann Meyer, Republican of Fort Dodge, Angela Davis, owner of Angie's Hair and Beauty Supply, and Barb Crooks, who is a standout girls basketball player at Fort Dodge Senior High School. Crooks will be the scorekeeper for the basketball game earlier in the afternoon. Throughout the afternoon, food will be provided by the Big Rob Experience, which is owned by Fort Dodge native Robert Presswood. The menu will include Jamaican rice and beans, curry chicken, and jerked chicken. Continuing with front page news, this headline reads, "Senate Group Announces Bipartisan Gun Deal. President, Plan Reflects Important Steps in the Right Direction," by Alan Fram of the Associated Press. Senate bargainers on Sunday announced the framework of a bipartisan response to last month's mass shootings, a noteworthy but limited breakthrough offering modest gun curbs and stepped-up efforts to improve school safety and mental health programs. The proposal falls far short of tougher steps long sought by President Joe Biden and many Democrats. Even so, the accord was embraced by Biden, and enactment would signal a significant turnabout after years of gun massacres that have yielded little but stalemate in Congress. Biden said in a statement that the framework does not do everything that I think is needed, but it reflects important steps in the right direction and would be the most significant gun safety legislation to pass Congress in decades. Given the bipartisan support, there are no excuses for delay and no reason why it should not quickly move through the Senate and the House, he said. Leaders hope to push any agreement into law rapidly, they hope this month, before the political momentum fades that has been stirred by the recent mass shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas. Participants cautioned that final details and legislative language remain to be completed, meaning fresh disputes and delays might emerge. In a consequential development, 20 senators, including 10 Republicans, released a statement calling for passage. That is potentially crucial, because the biggest obstacle to enacting the measure is probably in the 50-50 Senate, where at least 10 GOP votes will be needed to attain the usual 60-vote threshold for approval. Families are scared, and it is our duty to come together and get something done that will help restore their sense of safety and security in their communities, the lawmakers said. The group, led by Senators Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, Tom Tillis, Republican, North Carolina, and Kristen Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, produced the agreement after 2 weeks of closed-door talks. The compromise would make the juvenile records of gun buyers under age 21 available when they undergo background checks. The suspects who killed 10 black people at a grocery store in Buffalo and 19 students and two teachers at an elementary school in Uvalde were both 18, and many perpetrators of recent years' mass shootings have been young. The agreement would offer money to states to enact and put in place red flag laws that make it easier to temporarily take guns from people considered potentially violent, plus funds to bolster school safety and mental health programs. Some people who informally sell guns for profit would be required to obtain federal dealer's licenses, which means they would have to conduct background checks of buyers. Convicted domestic abusers who do not live with a former partner, such as estranged ex-boyfriends, would be barred from buying firearms, and it would be a crime for a person to legally purchase a weapon for someone who would not qualify for ownership. Congressional aides said billions of dollars would be spent expanding the number of community mental health centers and suicide prevention programs. But they said some spending decisions are unresolved, as are final wording on juvenile records and other gun provisions that might prove contentious. Yet underscoring election year pressures from Buffalo and Uvalde, the party's shared desire to demonstrate a response to those shootings suggested momentum toward enactment was strong. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, called the accord a good first step to ending the persistent inaction to the gun violence epidemic, and said he would bring the completed measure to a vote as soon as possible. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, who has supported the talks, was more restrained. He praised the bargainer's work and said he is hoping for a deal that makes significant headway on key issues like mental health and school safety, respects the Second Amendment, earns broad support in the Senate, and makes a difference for our country. The agreement was quickly endorsed by groups that support gun restrictions, including Brady, Every Town for Gun Safety, and March for Our Lives, which organized rallies held around the country on Saturday. And finally, on the first page is a picture feature headlined Celebration Rocks Fort Dodge. They're just pictures. I'll read the captions both on this page and on page 6. Celebration headliner Bret Michaels reaches out toward his fans Saturday night as he gets his set underway during the annual concert at the Harlan and Hazel Rogers Sports Complex in Fort Dodge. Stage smoke blasts into the air Saturday night at the conclusion of one of Bret Michaels' songs during the annual Celebration concert at the Harlan and Hazel Rogers Sports Complex. The smoke is generated by the release of pressurized carbon dioxide. Molly Hatchet guitarist Bobby Ingram performs for the crowd Saturday during the concert. Bret Michaels band guitarist Pete Evick at left and bass player Eric Biddingham take the front of the stage for a solo as Celebration headliner Bret Michaels sings behind them during the annual concert. Rainbow glow stick in hand, one of the thousands of fans who attended the annual Celebration concert, waits for headliner Bret Michaels to take the stage. Illuminated by her glowing glasses and a little wash of light from the stage, Janine Anderson of Fort Dodge sings along Saturday night during the annual concert. Mary Tillman of Boone celebrated her 44th birthday Saturday by attending the concert. Molly Hatchet guitarist Bobby Ingram plays against the afternoon sky Saturday as he performs a solo for the crowd during the annual concert. Trenton Bush, 9, of Churden, relaxes before the annual concert gets underway. Stephen McCutcheon and Audra Smith, both of Pipestone, Minnesota, paid homage to Bret Michaels' former band Poison as they attended the annual celebration. Jeremy Ober sings during the performance of Lone Tree Revival Saturday afternoon at the concert. Todd Monson of Fairmont, Minnesota, checks his watch Saturday afternoon while waiting in line for the gates to open at the annual celebration. Molly Hatchet guitarist Bobby Ingram and vocalist Jimmy Elkins perform Saturday during the annual event. There's another picture feature titled Art, Music, and More on page 2. The subheadline is Blandon Arts Festival Draws Families and Community Members. Nicole Canty, 4, of Webster City, draws another piece of artwork while her mother, Tyson Canty, watches during the annual Blandon Arts Festival Saturday at the Blandon Memorial Art Museum. Kristen Hovey of and Marlo Ruppel, 9, of Fort Dodge, look at crafts during the Blandon Arts Festival. Diane O'Hearn of Fort Dodge helps Margot Rogers, 9, of Manson, with her clay bowl during the annual festival. Jay Meter of Ames plays the piano for a crowd during the festival at the Blandon Memorial Art Museum. Lisa Glazer of Des Moines shows off the singing bowl during the Blandon Arts Festival. Ben Leal of the group Burnin' Sensations plays guitar. Nash Terry, 11, Lee Chua Chiako, 7, and Lyra Lane, 14, of Fort Dodge, play for the Arts Festival Saturday at the Blandon Memorial Art Museum in Fort Dodge. The children are students of the Gillette and Chan Music Academy. Ben Leal, Park Michaels, and Kate Sherrard of the Burnin' Sensations Band entertain at the museum. On page 3 is a headline reading, FD Council to Get Jail Presentation. The Fort Dodge City Council will learn about the proposal for a possible new jail and law enforcement center tonight. The council will begin its work at 5:30 p.m. in the Municipal Building, 819 First Avenue South, with a workshop on the jail proposal. The Council's regular business meeting will begin at 6 p.m. Items on the agenda include the second reading of an ordinance regarding the removal of dead and dying trees from private property. The Council will also consider the second reading of a measure that would renew the downtown self-supported municipal improvement district for another decade. That's an area in which property owners pay an extra tax to finance improvements there. Now moving to today's opinion page, there is a guest column by Iowa Senator Joni Ernst. It's titled, At Long Last, America's Heroes of World War II, the Army Rangers, Will Receive the Honor They Deserve. It was more than 80 years ago when a young man, still a student at East High School in Des Moines and a member of the class of 1940, enlisted in the Iowa National Guard. It was the beginning of a 26-year military career that would span three wars and include the participation in some of the most consequential battles in modern history. His name was Lester M. Cook. He was a member of our nation's greatest generation, but he was also a member of an exclusive rank of extraordinary individuals who played an indispensable role in America's victory in World War II, the original Darby Rangers of the 1st Ranger Battalion. The World War II Army Rangers were an elite corps of soldiers. Launched in 1942, the 1st Ranger Battalion traces its lineage directly to the modern-day Ranger Regiment, one of the most renowned fighting forces in the world. When it was first put together during the war, the Army Rangers were made up of 500 of the finest soldiers out of a group of more than 1,500 who volunteered to join. Sergeant Cook was among those who volunteered and was hand-picked to be trained with the rest of the select group at Achnacarry, Scotland. These heroes, like Sergeant Cook, engaged in some of the most ferocious and consequential fighting of the entire war, including the D-Day landings on the beaches of Normandy, the campaign in North Africa, and the Allies' advance through Italy. It is long past time that they receive the honor and recognition that they unquestionably deserve. That's why in 2019, I joined my fellow veteran, Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, to see to it that these elite soldiers of World War II are properly honored. Senator Duckworth and I introduced legislation to award them the Congressional Gold Medal, one of our nation's highest distinctions. Since then, Senator Duckworth and I, along with fellow veterans and members of the U.S. House of Representatives, Congresswoman Marionette Miller-Meeks of Iowa and Congressman Jason Crow of Colorado, have pushed relentlessly to get the bill signed into law. After a years-long bipartisan effort and with support from networks of veterans and their families from across the nation, in the last few weeks we pushed our legislation through Congress and to the President's desk, and just a few days ago our bill was signed into law. At long last, these heroes, the World War II Army Rangers, will receive the Congressional Gold Medal. I was so pleased to have the distinct opportunity to meet Sergeant Cook before he passed away in 2020. One of the great honors of my career as a U.S. Senator and a combat veteran was to be invited to join Sergeant Cook's family and friends for his memorial service. My staff and I were thrilled that Sergeant Cook was able to participate in a project we had undertaken to document the testimony of many of our nation's war heroes. Sergeant Cook discussed what the Congressional Gold Medal means to him and to his fellow Army Rangers. I regret that Sergeant Cook wasn't able to see this legislation get signed into law as he had long wished for, but I hope this Congressional Gold Medal, a small token of our nation's gratitude, will stand to honor his legacy, sacrifice, and selfless service, and that of his fellow Army Rangers for generations to come. To Sergeant Cook and to every single one of the men of the World War II Army Rangers, America's heroes, we say thank you. May our nation forever remember and honor your sacrifice. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican, represents Iowa. Continuing on the editorial page, this is a column by nationally syndicated columnist George F. Will. The title is The January 6th Hearings Vital Task. The U.S. presidential election of 1800 was and remains the most important election in world history, the first in which an incumbent party peacefully transferred power to the party that had defeated it. Perhaps the second most important election, it is mortifying to acknowledge, was that of 2020. 22 decades after this nation gave the world a glimpse of glittering political possibilities, this nation saw how perishable democratic manners are, even where they first prevailed. The Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol and the planning of it can present facts crucial to Congress's performing this legitimate function. supplying the public with information indispensable to understanding itself. The information's importance can be, but need not be, related to some legislative purpose. Telling an important story can be sufficient. Assembling the narrative of President John F. Kennedy's assassination, thereby dispelling conspiracy theories corrosive of social trust, was a sufficient justification for the 1963-1964 Warren Commission. The January 6th committee will forfeit the public's limited trust in it and the public's limited interest in it if members pursue pre-existing progressive agendas, such as abolition of the Electoral College or other changes to election law. Furthermore, Congress has neither a constitutional power nor an institutional aptitude for building a criminal case against Donald Trump. If the committee attempts this, it will sink into the quicksand of fascinating but legally problematic definitions of conspiracy and of speech that becomes illegal by inciting illegality. Free television, perhaps the most flamboyant congressional hearings, were those of the Senate Munitions Committee under Senator General Gerald P. Nye of North Dakota, the progressive Republican and fervid isolationist chosen by the Senate's Democratic majority to investigate suspicions that munitions makers, stigmatized as merchants of death, were to blame for U.S. entry into World War I. After 93 hearings, which began in 1934, the committee was abruptly defunded in 1936 because Nye suggested that President Woodrow Wilson had withheld pertinent information as Congress considered declaring war. The Senate's official webpage says Democratic leaders assailed Nye, with Senator Carter Glass of Virginia decrying him for dirt-daubing the sepulcher of Woodrow Wilson. The webpage continues, "Standing before cheering colleagues in a packed Senate chamber, Glass slammed his fist onto his desk until blood dripped from his knuckles. Then came television, and congressional hearings as spectacles, some useful, some inadvertently so. From 1950 to 1951, television turned Senator Estes Kefauver's Special Committee on Organized Crime in Interstate Commerce into national entertainment and turned the Tennessee Democrat into a presidential aspirant. He would be the Democrats' 1956 vice presidential nominee. Again, the Senate webpage. Schools dismissed students to watch the hearings. Blood banks ran low on donations, prompting one to install a television and tune into the hearings, and donations shot up 100%. When Kefauver's committee was due to expire in February 1951, protests from an addicted public got it extended until September. 2 years later, Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin, chairing the televised 1953-54 investigation of supposed communist influence in the Army, committed political suicide by being repulsive in front of a national audience that had hitherto only read about him. Select committees have riveted the nation by informing it about the Watergate, 1973, and Iran-Contra, 1987, scandals. But in those bygone days, before political tribalism suffocated many Americans' capacity for independent judgment, there was broad agreement that something deplorable had occurred in each case, and the hearings broadened agreement about that. Today, Republicans have almost entirely shunned the January 6th committee, and the Republican National Committee has described as legitimate political discourse the mob action that included smearing interior surfaces of the Capitol with feces. Furthermore, the comportment of senators of both parties during televised confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominees indicates that many people now in Congress are incapable of disinterested inquiries. Americans, numbed by the dregs of American society, behaving badly in high political offices, will not pay protracted attention to the committee. Still, the committee can usefully provide testimony about how on that day the president, surrounded by lickspittle mediocrities and allied with many such in both houses of Congress, reaped what he had and they had sown, chaos. But the committee's first, most important and sufficient task is to show what happened. Video cameras are ubiquitous. Even the rioters carried smartphones as well as stupid banners. Today, most people absorb most of what they learn about public matters from pictures. By disseminating the graphic record of January 6th, the committee can serve the nation by deepening its embarrassment, which is a necessary first step toward the recovery of its dignity. Again, that is a column by nationally syndicated columnist George F. Will. And now from page 2, here is the feature, This Date in History, by the Associated Press. Today is Monday, June 13th, the 164th day of 2022. There are 201 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history. On June 13th, 1967, President Lyndon B. Johnson nominated Solicitor General Thurgood Marshall to become the first Black justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. On this date in 1865, Nobel Prize-winning poet playwright William Butler Yeats was born in Dublin, Ireland. In 1966, the Supreme Court ruled in Miranda v. Arizona that criminal suspects had to be informed of their constitutional right to consult with an attorney and to remain silent. In 1977, James Earl Ray, the convicted assassin of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., was recaptured following his escape 3 days earlier from a Tennessee prison. And here are today's hints from Heloise. Swimming safety. Today's sound off is about teaching your child to swim. Dear Heloise, nearly 7 years ago, I lost my son in a boating accident. He was only 5 years old and didn't know how to swim. I always thought I'd enroll him in swimming classes when he got a little older. My ex took him out for a boat ride on the lake, and although he had on a life jacket, it wasn't fastened in front, and he slipped out of it when he fell out of the boat. In only a matter of minutes, he was gone forever. I can't stress enough how important it is for a child to learn this valuable skill. If my son had known how to swim, he might have survived. I've since learned that even infants can be taught how to swim. It's wonderful exercise, and you never know when it might come in handy. I would urge every parent to see to it that their child is taught to swim and to not be afraid of the water. Signed, Laura S., Waukesha, Wisconsin. Laura, swimming is an easy skill to learn, and everyone should know how to swim. If nothing else, a swimmer can be taught how to float and do a backstroke if they become tired while swimming. Knowing how to swim has saved many lives, including my own. Heloise. Fast Facts. Things your child should know before entering kindergarten. Their full name, address, and phone number. How to make a phone call. The names of colors. How and when to say please and thank you. How to dress themselves, tie their shoelaces, and comb their hair. Sleeping bags. Dear Heloise, with summer comes camping for my family. We love getting out to enjoy the outdoors, cooking over a campfire, and hiking. The only problem is that we need to clean our sleeping bags. What should I do to get them clean? Lisa H., Aspen, Colorado. Lisa, first look at the directions on a label that should be attached to your sleeping bag and follow the manufacturer's recommendations. Most bags can be washed, and if your sleeping bag is one of those, use warm water on a gentle cycle. You will probably have to use the spin cycle twice to get all the excess water out. One of the best ways to dry your sleeping bag is to unzip it and spread it out on the patio or clothesline and let it dry in the sun. Have fun camping. Heloise. Faulty faucet. Dear Heloise, I had a dripping faucet, and although my dad said he could fix it, he couldn't get to my place until the weekend. The dripping was driving me crazy, so I tried one of your suggestions. I tied a string around the faucet and got the water to run down the string and into the drain. At least I didn't have to listen to a dripping faucet for 3 days. Brenda L., Englewood, New Jersey. And here are some of the club meeting notices for this week. The Centel Frontier Retirees and Auxiliary will meet at 11:30 a.m. on Thursday at Peking Garden, 2510 Fifth Avenue South. Daybreak Rotary Club, 7 a.m. Tuesday, Boardroom, Triton Cafe, Iowa Central Community College. Fort Dodge Noon Rotary, noon Monday, Shiny Top Brewing, 520 Central Avenue. Fort Dodge Noon Kiwanis, noon Tuesday, Pizza Ranch, 3311 Fifth Avenue South. Noon Lions, 11:30 a.m. Wednesday, The Lion's Den, 731 Exposition Drive. Noon Sertoma Club, noon Thursday, Pizza Ranch, 3311 Fifth Avenue South. Alcohol Dependency Groups, the Alano Club, meets at 10:30 a.m. and 6 p.m. Sunday, 1408 Fifth Avenue South. Al-Anon Family Group, noon Sunday, 1408 Fifth Avenue South. Al-Anon Family Group, noon Monday, First United Methodist Church, 127 North 10th Street. Al-Anon Family Group, 5 p.m. Thursday, 1408 Fifth Avenue South. Alano Club, 8 p.m. Friday, Come to Believe Group, 1408 Fifth Avenue South. Alano Club, noon Saturday, 1408 Fifth Avenue South. Weight Control, WW, 8:30 a.m. Saturday, First Congregational UCC, 1611 Williams Drive, Fort Dodge. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, June 13, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Gary L. Cruz, 85, of Gowrie, passed away Saturday, June 11, 2022, at his home. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, June 15, 2022, at the United Methodist Church, Gowrie, with Pastor Susan Roden officiating. Burial will be at Callender Cemetery. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, June 14th at the Palmer Funeral Home, Gowrie. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Gary is survived by his wife, Joyce, their children, Jeff, Ann, Cruz of Gowrie, Kevin, Patty, Cruz of Callender, Kenneth, Joni Cruz of Fort Dodge, and Tammy, Kurt Donahue of Farnhamville. 7 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, and other relatives and friends. Helen Betty Griffin, age 88, of Lawrence, passed away on Saturday, June 11, 2022, at Avira Heart Hospital in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Funeral services will be 10 a.m. Thursday, June 16, 2022, at Resurrection of Our Lord Catholic Church in Pocahontas, Iowa, with Father Craig Collison officiating. Burial will be in St. John's Cemetery near Gilmore City, Iowa. Visitation is from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, June 15, 2022, at Powers Funeral Home, Sacred Heart Chapel in Lawrence, Iowa. Vigil service will be 3:45 p.m. Wednesday, June 15, 2022, at the funeral home in Lawrence. Powers Funeral Home of Lawrence, Iowa, is handling the arrangements. For online condolences and obituary, visit powersfh.net. Lucille M. Peterson, 84, of Fort Dodge, passed away Saturday, June 11, 2022, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Services are pending at Laufersweiler Funeral Home. Kathy Lenz of Palmer. Funeral Mass will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday at St. Thomas Catholic Church, Manson. Visitation 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday at Larson Weishar Funeral Home. David Dave Thomas Kelly, age 69, of Monona, Wisconsin, passed away on Tuesday, June 7, 2022, in Monona, surrounded by all his daughters. A memorial service will be held at Gunderson East Funeral and Cremation Care, 5203 Monona Drive, Madison, at 10 a.m. on Monday, June 13, 2022. Dave is survived by his 3 sisters, Pat Kelly, Peggy Craig Murphy, and Sheila Mark Osman, 3 daughters, Erin, Andy Bober, Kelly Bober, Sarah Fraser, and Katie Eric Innocenti. 5 grandchildren, Hattie, Avery, Cleo, Bryn, and Julius, and numerous nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, Tom T.X. and Ginny Kelly. Michael R. Halligan, 61, passed away January 20, 2022. A massive Christian burial will be 10 a.m. Saturday, June 18, 2022 at Holy Trinity Church. A burial will follow in Corpus Christi Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, also at Holy Trinity Church, with a rosary beginning at 3:30. Memorials may be left to family discretion. Laufersweiler Funeral Home is serving the family. Dolores Clapp, 95, of Fort Dodge, formerly of Minnesota, passed away Saturday, June 11, 2022, at her home in Fort Dodge. Services are pending with Laufersweiler Funeral Home. There is 1 or 2 notices here that is in the Laufersweiler Funeral Home advertisement that was not included in today's obituaries. They are Donna L. Vogel, age 82, services are pending, and Marianne Harrigan, age 95, says services at a later date. That concludes today's obituaries. Iowa justices deny appeals by 2 men, Des Moines. 2 Des Moines men who were sentenced to life in prison without parole for murders committed when they were teenagers must stay behind bars, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled on Friday. James Dorsey and Fernando Sandoval have been trying for decades to have their convictions and sentences overturned. This time, lawyers argued that their clients should not have been tried as adults because the crimes were committed when they were 18 and 19 years old. In Dorsey's case, he was only 5 days past his 18th birthday when he killed Juanita Weaver during a home invasion in 1984. He argued that modern medical and social science shows the brain does not fully mature until age 25, the Des Moines Register reported. State law states that youth who commit crimes before they turn 18 cannot be sentenced to life in prison without parole, but once someone turns 18, they face the full penalties prescribed by law. Now we'll turn to the sports page. Headline reads, Travis Abab amateur at Lakeside, Pede delivers. FD golfer wins first career Habab Am title. 92 St. Edmund grad finishes single stroke ahead of Alt Morrow by Eric Pratt. The new grandpa on the golf course still has a few tricks up his sleeve. Lucas Pede showed the young bucks how it's done on Sunday, capturing the 2022 Travis J. Habab amateur at Lakeside Golf Course. The 1992 St. Edmund graduate edged 7-time Habab champ Kevin Alt and 2020 winner Austin Morrow by a single stroke, finishing at 6 under par 102. The 47-year-old Pede became a grandfather nearly 2 years ago and now enjoys spending time with grandkids Tucker and Marin. That doesn't mean the competitive juices aren't flowing, though, once the 3-time City Gold medalist enters a tournament. It's a matter of getting out and not just playing, but playing well again, said Pede, who won the event for the first time in his career. I got a lesson recently from local professional Judd Gibb, and things have clicked since then. He knows my swing. Sometimes in this sport, it's just a small adjustment here or there that makes a big difference. I have Tucker out on the course with me a lot. I owe the adjustments to Judd, but the fun and perspective to Tucker. Pede and Charlie West both carded 5-under par 67s in the qualifying round for the championship 9. Morrow, 69, defending champion Cole Jayski, 70, Cody Jayski, 70, Scott Bergman, 70, and Jordan Morrow, 70, also landed in the red and within 3 strokes of the lead heading into the home stretch. It's always a tough field, and there were a lot of guys who were right there. I knew there would be, Pede said. I just stayed aggressive and had to keep making birdies. I got one right away at the par 5 10th, another one at 13, which helped. Honestly, my putting was great. It was one of those days where I rolled a lot of putts in. If you're doing that, you're going to score well. The greens were fantastic, and the course is in outstanding condition. Alt and Morrow both closed at 5-under 103. West, 104, was fourth, followed by the Jayski brothers, 107, and Jordan Morrow, 107. Bergman, 108, Andrew Huseman, 109, and Eddie Doyle, 111, rounded out the top 10. Continuing on the first page of the sports section, Iowa-owned horse captures Belmont Stakes by Jake Siner of the Associated Press. Triple Crown veteran Todd Pletcher had simple advice Saturday for jockey Arad Ortiz Jr. before the Belmont Stakes. Be patient, Pletcher said. I think you have the best last quarter of any horse in the race. Sometimes less is mo. Mo Donegal, partially owned by an attorney from Des Moines, pulled away down the home stretch and held off Philly Nest to win the Belmont Stakes, giving Pletcher a 1-2 finish and his 6th Triple Crown victory, including 4 at this track on the outskirts of New York City. To be honest with you, we were a little confident going into the race today, said Donegal Racing CEO and co-owner Jerry Crawford, who grew up in southern Iowa's Warren County. When he turned for home, I was like, forget about it. I know Todd thought he could get a strong last quarter mile, and he surely did. Rich Strike, a stunning Kentucky Derby winner at 80-1 odds, was 6th. Mo Donegal rounded the 1.5-mile distance in 2 minutes, 28.28 seconds, 3 lengths ahead of Nest, ridden by Ortiz's brother, Jose. Pletcher, who lives on Long Island, adds another Belmont title following wins with Rags to Riches in 2007, Palace Malice in 2013, and Taprit in 2017. Mo Donegal beat an 8-horse field without a clear favorite. We the People, a monster in the mud, opened at 2-1 amid a rainy forecast but reached 7-2 by race time as showers held off. Mo Donegal entered the gate, the betting favorite at 5-2. We the People led for much of the race, but Mo Donegal and Ortiz took charge coming out of the final turn. The 3-year-old colt paid $7.20, $3.80, and $3. Nest, who nearly became Pletcher's second filly to win Belmont after Rags to Riches, paid $5.30 and $4.10. Skippy Longstocking was third and returned $5.60 to show. We the People finished fourth. Rich Striker owner Rick Dawson and trainer Eric Reed held the Kentucky Derby winner out of the Preakness with an eye on Belmont, the first healthy horse to skip Pimlico after winning the Triple Crown's first event since 1985. Reed said the team encouraged jockey Sonny Leon to try pushing Rich Strike from the outside, but the horse kept trying to get back inside, where he made a late charge past 19 horses to win at Churchill Downs. Rich Strike spent much of the race in last place and couldn't recover. I think we just made a tactical error, Reed said. Just like Rich Strike, Mo Donegal was at the back of the pack at the Derby, but the colt didn't have enough kick at Churchill Downs. He found it Saturday, winning the 154th running of the $1.5 million race. Mo Donegal made a winner out of co-owner Mike Repole, a local entrepreneur known around the track as Mike from Queens. Repole also co-owns Nest. This is New York's biggest race, and to win it here with my family and friends and 70 people here, this will be a big winner's circle, he said. It's the fourth straight year the Triple Crown contests were won by three different horses, a first for the sport since 1926 through 1929. McElroy repeats at Canadian Open. Toronto, this is from the Associated Press. Roy McElroy won the RBC Canadian Open on Sunday and gave the PGA Tour a strong response to the start of the Saudi-funded LIV Golf Invitational, closing with an 8-under-62 to win a wild race to the finish with Justin Thomas and Tony Finau. McElroy had his first title defense on the PGA Tour, even if he had to wait for it. He won golf's fourth-oldest national open in 2019 at Hamilton Golf and Country Club, only for the COVID-19 pandemic to cancel the next two editions. Thomas pushed him to the end at St. George's Golf and Country Club, and the tournament effectively ended on the 17th hole. McElroy and Thomas were tied and in the rough. McElroy hit a wedge that rolled out to tap in range, while Thomas missed a 10-foot par putt, a two-shot swing. Thomas closed with a pair of bogeys and still shot 64. McElroy finished at 19-under-261 for a two-stroke victory. I feel like it's getting tougher and tougher to win on the PGA Tour, McElroy said. Just look at the two guys that I played with today. I went out with a lead and had to shoot 8-under-par to get the job done. So the depth of talent on this tour is really, really impressive. And going up against guys like JT and Tony and coming out on top, that's something to feel really good about. Finau holed a 40-foot birdie putt on the 18th for 64 to finish second alone. Roy played great, Finau said. He closed it out, and hats off to him on a week like this. That's fantastic playing on the weekend. I played great. He just played a couple shots better. Thomas was third at 14-under. Justin Rose matched the tournament and course record with a 60, with three eagles and three bogeys, to tie for fourth with Sam Burns, 65, at 14-under. The Canadian crowd was enormous, having been kept away since 2019, and thousands surrounded the 18th green as the threesome of McElroy, Thomas, and Finau finished. And the last item on page one of the sports section, historic NASCAR victory for Suarez at Sonoma, by Greg Beecham of the Associated Press. Daniel Suarez had tears in his eyes for so many reasons Sunday after he realized a lifelong dream by crossing the finish line first at Sonoma Raceway. While Suarez was overjoyed to become the first Mexican-born driver to win a NASCAR Cup Series race, he quickly felt overwhelmed with gratitude and memories of his motorsports journey. He also thought about the multitude of fans backing him across the continent and beyond, including several hundred red-shirted supporters screaming their hearts out in the Sonoma grandstands as part of his Daniel's Amigos outreach program. I just feel extremely lucky, Suarez said, after holding off Chris Buescher to the checkered flag. I'm fortunate to be that driver that the whole Hispanic community can connect with, he added. I feel like I have an entire country and community behind me. The people wearing red shirts today, those are my people. Some of them, they have exactly the same journey I have, coming from Mexico, not knowing the language, trying to find an opportunity, having goals, and trying to make that dream happen. These are my people, and I feel lucky to be the person to represent all of them. Despite those poignant thoughts, this occasion was not solemn for the 30-year-old native of Monterey, who finally won the 195th career start of a Cup Series career that began in 2017. After his tears dried in the car, he quickly called for the piñata shaped like a taco that he's been keeping on hand for his first win, and he celebrated by punching a hole through it with his fist. Nobody knows how much sweat, sacrifice, and tears this has caused me, Suarez said. This whole time I was always dreaming about winning in the Cup Series. Suarez drove his Trackhouse Racing Chevrolet to the third Cup Series victory of the season for this rising two-year-old team co-owned by former driver Justin Marks and music star Pitbull. Suarez got past Buescher and took charge early in the final stage on this hilly road course in Northern California wine country, and he persevered through a pit stop and a caution to emerge in front with 23 laps to go. Buescher pushed him aggressively, but Suarez made no significant mistakes while rolling to victory. Buescher's second-place finish was also a season best in his RFK Racing Ford. He fell just short of his second career victory. "Hurts to be that close, but congratulations to Suarez," Buescher said. "We were trying to get him. Ran out of steam there." Suarez is the fifth foreign-born driver to win a Cup Series race, and he's the first to win on all three of NASCAR's National Series. He won the Xfinity Series Championship in 2016, and he also won a Truck Series race that year. Now here's the area sports roundup. Twin Lakes Youth Triathlon on July 2nd. The fifth annual Twin Lakes Youth Triathlon will take place at Twin Lakes Bible Camp on Saturday, July 2nd. The inaugural race was held in 2018 with less than 24 participants, but it has grown through the years to 100 youth athletes between the ages of 5 and 16 competing. The senior race will start at 8 a.m. for youth aged 11 to 16 years old. They will swim 200 meters in the lake off the Bible Camp docks before heading out on a two-lap fast, flat, 4-mile bike portion, then onto a 1-mile run to finish their race outside the gathering place. The junior race will begin after the last senior triathlete crosses the finish line. Youngest athletes are 5 to 10 years old. They take on a 50-meter swim, 2-mile bike, and half-mile run. They start and end their race at the same location as the senior athletes. Junior athletes are allowed to use life jackets for their swim portion. Every triathlete will receive a custom Twin Lakes Youth Triathlon backpack with their entry fee, and all finishers will receive a finisher medal. The top three athletes in each age and gender will receive an award. The event is timed by True Time Racing and is put on by Twin Lakes Bible Camp and Twin Lakes Tri Club. You can register your athlete at www.twinlakesbiblecamp.org/youth-triathlon. Entry fees increase on June 15th. More information on the youth-based Tri Club is at twinlakestriclub.com. For more information or questions, please contact Shaylin at twinlakestriclub.com. Jaguar softball team tops Eagle Grove. The Southeast Valley softball team posted a 5-2 win over Eagle Grove. Maddie Van Sickle struck out 12 in the victory. Van Sickle also slugged a two-run home run. And some other local sports briefs. This is from the area scoreboard column. Humboldt blanks Algona in softball. The Humboldt softball team topped Algona here Friday night 7-0. Riley Coyle was 2-for-3 with a home run, while Macy Van Anken had two hits, including a triple. Elise Hubble also had a triple, and Reagan Lee tossed a four-hitter for the Wildcats. Manthai Cougars roll. The Manson Northwest Webster baseball team claimed a 5-1 victory over GTRA here Friday night. Dylan Manthai earned the win, striking out 10 batters for the Cougars. He also had a double, as did Alec Whitehill and Lane Moline. Caden Anderson was 2-for-3 with a triple and two RBI, while Austin Jaschke also drove in a pair. Jags still unbeaten in TLC softball action. Southeast Valley remained undefeated in the Twin Lakes Conference with a 12-7 win over Alta Aurelia on Friday. Jordan Rowley was a perfect 4-for-4 at the plate with 3 runs scored and 4 RBI for the Jaguars, 6-6 overall. Alex Kitchen added a pair of hits, as did Lauren Eslick. Chloe Lambert and Maddie Van Sickle combined for the win. Late rally saved Southeast Valley. Southeast Valley topped Alta Aurelia at home in baseball on Friday 5-3. Jaguars plated 4 runs in the bottom of the 6th to rally. Brady Hansen and Hayne Sorensen drove in runs, with Sorensen earning the victory in relief. Colson Kurse and Caden Larson both added hits and runs scored. Sign-up period continues for FDAM. The 74th annual Fort Dodge Amateur Golf Tournament will be June 25th and 26th at Fort Dodge Country Club. The event will feature 36 holes of regulation play, 18 on Saturday and 18 on Sunday, followed by a championship 9 on Sunday evening. Entry fee is $100 for the open, senior, or super senior divisions. Cost is $50 for those age 23 and under. Entry fee includes golf, range balls, and a complimentary lunch. Payouts will be in cash prizes with over $6,000 in overall prize money. For more information or to sign up, please visit fdamgolf.com or call 515-955-8551. Title for Baisha's squad. Kyle Baisha, a 2016 Fort Dodge senior high graduate, recently helped KB Tutaduras win a second straight Albania Basketball League Superliga championship. Baisha averaged 14.8 points and shot 55% from the field, making 56 of 108 three-point attempts. And here is the advice column titled, Dear Annie. Son is headed toward debt. Dear Annie, my 19-year-old son has been floating through life since he graduated from high school. He decided early in May that he was not going to return to college, so my husband, his stepdad, who has been in his life since he was 4, and I decided that he either needs to move out by July 1st or have a full-time job with a goal that he is working toward that we all agree on. Enter my sister. Last weekend, she co-signed a loan for $23,000 for a 2016 truck that has over 100,000 miles on it. She also allowed him to move into her house. She did not discuss any of this with us. He works at a hardware store part-time and makes $250 to $300 a week. His truck payment is $440 a month, insurance is about $170, and gas is at least $100 a week. This lifestyle is not financially sustainable. We think she basically allowed him to run away from responsibility, and we are very angry that she allowed, because she co-signed the loan, to get himself into a mountain of debt he can't afford to be in. Am I wrong to be upset with her? I know he is an adult and can make his own decisions, but I feel like she should have had a conversation with me before doing all this. Literally, we found out about her offer at 9 p.m. on the night before they did this. He just came home with a truck and packed up to leave. Seriously upset at my sister. Dear Seriously, you have every right to be frustrated with your sister's enabling behavior. Here you are trying to teach your son the value of a dollar in hard work, and she comes along and co-signs a big loan for him so that he thinks he can have free money. So yes, you should have a talk with your sister and explain the life lessons you are trying to teach your son. However, don't forget that if he can't make the payments on the truck, she will be stuck with having to come up with the money. Although he is legally an adult, he is still your son, and you have a right to give him good advice on how to live his life, starting by explaining that hard-earned financial independence is a sign of adulthood. Dear Annie, in reply to the wife whose mother-in-law has hinted at moving in with her son and daughter-in-law, I thought of an additional way the daughter-in-law could address her mother-in-law's possible loneliness. The wife might consider becoming knowledgeable about the senior residences in her local area. It would, of course, be helpful if she knew someone who resided in one of the local senior residences and has a favorable impression of her living situation. Most of these residences allow people to visit for lunch and tour the facilities. At times, a resident does participate in the lunch gathering of a visitor. Of course, the wife might have to approach this gradually and be sure the senior residence enjoys a good reputation. The mother-in-law could use the proceeds from the sale of her house to fund her living arrangements at the senior residence. The son and wife could assure the mother-in-law that they understand she might be lonely, but at this time, moving in with them is not an answer. However, they would still see each other often if she were in a local senior residence. If the mother-in-law is pet-friendly, having a pet also helps with loneliness. Signed, Senior Advocate. Dear Senior Advocate, thank you for your wonderful suggestion. And we'll finish up with some sports history. On this date in national sports, 1953, Ben Hogan wins the U.S. Open for the fourth time with a six-stroke victory over Sam Snead. 1959, Billy Casper wins the U.S. Open Golf Tournament over Bob Rosberg. 1982, Jan Stevenson wins the LPGA Championship with a two-stroke triumph over Joanne Carner. 1991, The National, the nation's first all-sports daily newspaper, ceases publication. 1997, Chicago wins its fifth NBA championship in the last 7 years, as Steve Kerr's last-second shot gives the Bulls a 90-86 Game 6 win victory over the Utah Jazz. 2011, Boston scores four times in a 4-14 span of the first period and beats the Vancouver Canucks 5-2 in Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final at TD Garden, evening the best-of-seven series. 2012, Matt Cain pitches the 22nd perfect game in Major League history and first for San Francisco, striking out a career-high 14 batters and getting help from two running catches by outfielders Melky Cabrera and Gregor Blanco to beat the Houston Astros 10-0. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, June 13th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.